I'm interviewing you on behalf of SABR, Society for American Baseball Research, and this information that you give me, this tape, we're going to use, we might put it on the internet, we'll maybe share it with other researchers, that type of thing. Is that okay?
Well, are they going to use this for any kind of financial gain or anything?
No.
Well, that's
and
fine.
If they at any point did, the only person who ever would be me. Like maybe if some of this stuff's like really interesting, I decide I want to do a book, but then I would come to you first.
Oh, great. That's okay with me.
We want to protect your interests most of all. Okay. Well, you put your name in AOL in the search engine and you get about 1,500 matches. Just put in Jesse Gonder. That's
it.
It's unbelievable, all the stuff that's in here.
Yeah, but my daughter told me I don't even deal with that.
Well, I got a lot of your stuff here, and basically, I guess maybe we just start out at the beginning. You grew up here in Oakland, right?
Yes, I grew up in Oakland.
And maybe my question there is, when did you realize that you first realized that you might have a shot at playing professional baseball?
Well, after Jackie Robinson. They allowed Jackie Robinson to come into the big leagues, and... Yeah, we had a group of guys here in Oakland. Frank Robinson, Vader Pinson, Curtis Flood, myself, and a guy named Kurt Roberts before us, and Charlie Beeman. We were all good athletes. And Frank was the first one to sign and went to the big leagues. And after he signed professional, then we all figured we had a pretty good chance of going. We had one guy, George Pohl was our coach, and we had one guy, a scout named Bob Maddox. He eventually ended up being the general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. He signed all of us to the Cincinnati Reds organization. But I thought I had a chance as soon as Robinson was allowed to play in the big leagues.
So this guy from Cincinnati came in and pretty much cleaned house as far as Oakland was concerned with good black ball players. He came in and took them all.
He really did. And he cleaned up financially, too.
Really?
I had no idea. None of us have an idea, of what was going down. We all received small bonuses, because during those days, if you received over $4,000 a sign, you had to go on a big league roster. You couldn't have a minor league contract, so that was out. And according to him, each one of us that went to the big leagues, he got a $10,000 signing bonus. So three of my teammates, we all went. So he cleaned up.
So how much of that $10,000 did you see?
Zero.
Wow.
None of it. I guess these scouts, the same thing happened now. I guess they get more. When they sign a kid and it goes to the big leagues.
And what would have happened if you had gone to the guy and said, hey, I want some of this $10,000? You had no idea.
I had no idea. He just told me this later on in the years that this what went down. He said, I told him, I said, what are you making off of us? Matter of fact, we were sitting at a bar having a drink. And he told me, he said, this was long before anybody went to the big league. He said, if you get to the big leagues, I get a $10,000 bonus. Well, to this day, I don't know whether he's telling me the truth or not, but I do know we made him famous.
So all those guys went on?
Yes.
Everybody?
Yeah. And not only that, other guys, he didn't only sign all of us out of Mac, he signed some out of Tech, Castlemont. He was in this area, it made him.
Hmm. So you went to McLennan?
Right.
And graduated in
1955.
So how was that team? That Climbins.
That team
must have been competitive.
I'm not sure how accurate I am on this date, but I believe the last 3 years of that club we went undefeated.
Wow!
I came in on the bottom of it. See, I was in school. Curtis and I was in the same grade. Frank was ahead of us, but and Vader was right behind me. So I was in school with all of them, right in the middle of them. And a guy named Charlie Beeman, that he signed with Baltimore, went up and beat the Yankees. that they had a high school team. We had two guys, one named Joe Jacobs, one named Jerry Jacobs. And they signed professional, both of them, shortstop, second baseman. And we went 32-0.
Wow.
And we had a catcher named, matter of fact, he the one got me into catching, Matthew Kellamrose, one of the best receivers anywhere.
What was his last name?
Kellamrose, Matthew Kellamrose. Yeah, he passed away now. And he signed professional, but he didn't last long. You know, a lot of guys. See, back in those days, being black, if you couldn't accept being humiliated, or insulted, I should say, insulted, you know, you couldn't accept being called nigger and Wallin' on Eater, Amos and Andy, any racial insult that they possibly threw at you, then you couldn't make it. Because believe me, that's what happened in those days. From the time I signed, which I signed in 1955, up until I guess we in the mid 60s. Because Cincinnati, when I was in Cincinnati, we were the first team to integrate spring training. We stayed at the same motel with the white players in 1960. Was 1962.
So what position did you play before you caught?
I was outfielder. I played quite a bit of outfield in professional baseball. I didn't play it in the big leagues, but I played it all through the minor leagues. I played whether I was catching. In other words, they tried to get my bat in there because I could always hit.
So what you're saying is, at this level, with high school, when you're McClymans, that the guys who had the rabbit ears and let the taunting get to them, they didn't have a chance.
No, I'm talking about once they signed professional.
Once they signed professional.
What,
you never get heckled here in high school.
Oh, no. None of that in high school. I'm talking about these guys the guys that I named, that has all these guys that signed professional. The ones that, I don't know, what would you say, had thick hair, whatever you want to say.
Thick skin.
Thick skin, that's the word I'm trying to think of. We the one that made it. Now, we weren't the best athletes, but we had thicker skin, and we do what we had to do in order to survive. And I had two or three teammates after Frank had graduated. Was probably maybe better ball players than any of us, but they just couldn't stand the insult, and stuff, and they called it quits.
You're too hot-headed, or
no? It wasn't hot. It was hot. The idea of not being here. Why would you want to take the humiliation?
Yeah.
You know, baseball. Other than the people I met in baseball, I met some good people in baseball, and I had some good times in baseball. But with what I had to go through in baseball, it really wasn't that much fun. Once I got into the game and I found out how political it was, and then I realized what was going to hold me back, you know, it ceased being fun. I put it right there.
Really?
Yeah, it really did. Nothing fun about it.
Now, when you were in the minor leagues, let's see, 55 to 60, where you were... Did you run into a lot of racism?
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you.
Ogden, even places like Ogden,
everywhere,
Utah.
Everywhere you ran into racism.
Wow.
Everywhere. You know, a lot of places we couldn't even go in and eat with the white players. We had to sit out of the bus while they brought us, after they finished eating hamburgers and things. We had the guy named Jerry Jacobs was a white player with the Mac. He later became a bus driver, and that's what I did after I got out of baseball. But he wanted to know how could I take the insults. I'll tell you a story. When we first signed, he signed a year before I did, and he had a guy named James Langford. They signed a year before I did, and then the next year that I signed, we all left here, 16th Street Railroad Station, going to Douglas, Georgia. That's the spring train with Cincinnati Reds. And I remember we all went to school together. We all grew up together in West Oakland. And everything was fine until we got to Chicago. And once we got to Chicago and was going south, Langford and I, when I walked on, we got on the train, I saw, all the black people sitting in one place. So I just automatically went and sat down. It never occurred to me what was going on. I just went and sat down with the black people. Jerry came and sat with us too. And the porter came back there and got him and said, you can't stay here. You can't sit here. You got to go up there with the white. This was the first time that he had gotten a taste of it. We get to Atlanta, Georgia, and it was late. It was cold. I was hungry and everything. So we asked this man, what can we get something to eat this late at night? So he told us right down there. And we went down there, and his place was open. And Jerry and I walked in together. I still haven't hit me what's happening. Langford, he stayed outside. I didn't pay much attention. So Jerry and I sat down beside each other. And the waitress came over to order Jerry, took Jerry's order. And Jerry said, well, what about him? He come here. Aren't you going to take his order? And she said, well, yeah, but he got to go to the window. Go back outside to the window. So I went back outside and looked up at the window. It says, color only. Well, I got fooled. I wasn't hungry. So we go back to the train station, and we have a little waiting room about, 8 feet by 8, whatever. And this is about 1 o'clock. Jerry got a big, huge waiting room. So he doesn't want to go over there. He's afraid. So he come over on the outside, and we all sitting there again. The security guard came and told him he had to move. So this is just some of the experience that I was started out with.
Well, how awful! What a bad place to go. I mean, you go to spring training, and here it is, right in the middle of the South.
Yeah, well, all the spring training was like that.
Were they
back then? That's what all of them was like that. Yeah,
So how was that? Go on from there. Tell me what happened.
It's a
spring training.
It's the same thing. We had to stay in private homes. All the black players had to stay with black families. And this is in Douglas, Georgia. Then when I got to the big league camp, Cincinnati Reds, same thing. We had the Cardinals, the Yankees, Cincinnati. We were all in St. Petersburg, Tampa, in which they are right there together. But we all live with the same black family. I never forget the name of Miss Felder. She had a huge home, and the black players off of the Cardinals and the Yankees, Eston Howard and Hector Lopez, and the rest of us off the Reds, we all lived with her.
It was like a boarding house.
It was a big boarding house, right? Yes, she right. Uh-huh. And she cooked and everything for us.
So, how'd you do in that spring training?
Oh, I did great. It didn't bother me. You never had the problems on the field. You were there. I never had any problem with my teammates. Period. Now, early on, you would have a small amount of problem with the opposite team, but basically, we never had any problem with the white teammates or the white opposition, except being knocked down. But that was no big deal.
So, did you think you had any chance of making the team that year in 55? You just were there as...
No, I knew it. I knew I had... Not the big league team.
Right, not
no,
the big
no,
team.
No. I know I never had a chance. See, in those days, I don't know whether... Well, any of the other guys that told you, you had...
Yeah.
D-ball,
right.
They told you, okay, from D-C.
50 million teams.
Yeah, 50 million teams, right. At one time, the Dodgers had 3 AAA teams that won championship at the same year.
Wow.
So, our problem was making the team. We was trying to advance as high as possible. in the classification.
Right.
So I started in C-ball, Ogden, Utah.
You're right. So you could have actually, that was pretty good. That was, you could have started in
D-ball. Right. That's right.
Rookie ball.
That, yeah. Rookie ball. No, rookie ball. Nothing but, no rookie ball.
Hi.
So at Ogden, Utah that year, you bet a 270.
The largest Honda dealer in the Midwest.
You get 1,500.
My name is Tiffany, and I'm here.
And tell me about that. Yeah. What do you remember?
The problem, what kept me back was, like I said, to be a catcher, you got to catch.
Penske Honda has the largest selection.
I was such a good hitter that no matter where I went, they wanted to play me. So if they had somebody that was a pretty good catcher, they'd play me in the outfield. Now, and every team I went with, the manager wanted to show me how to catch. And I was really kind of screwed up in the head, being a catcher. And I didn't start, I didn't begin to understand about catching until I met a guy named Jim Higgin, mm-hmm. who was coach with the, in the Yankee organization.
Sure.
And after he took me on his wing, a tutelage or whatever you want to say, and didn't catch him, started to come around. But until then, I had a real problem behind home plate. But I could always hit.
What were some of your problems behind home plate?
Just receiving the ball. It wasn't anything that I was quick. I had a good arm. I had one real good arm. Just receiving the ball. You know, it's something that you got to, it's not learned overnight.
Right.
You need to be back there. You need to be behind home plate.
Got
to
make it instinctive.
I could always call a good game. And that's, hey, cut the, let me go. I'll take it. Okay, like I said, I was pretty naive when it came to race because it never really occurred to me. Segregation and prejudice and stuff like that never really occurred to me. And it was a long time before I realized what was going on. And you asked me a few minutes ago what did I have problems I had with my catching. I never had any problem calling again. Because I've always been pretty smart. I thought like a hitter, so I called the game like a hitter. But I wasn't aware that I wasn't supposed to be able to think. You know, matter of fact, this helped me back because I just didn't understand why I couldn't say what I felt. And if I write, then I was not going to back down. And when this came to my attention, I was with the Mets. And Chris Canizera was another guy that went to San Leandro, a good friend of mine. I went to Mac. We graduated the same year, and I believe every year. We know our career ran parallel. And we ended up being teammates together with the Mets. Every time that I'd catch, we was platoon. Casey had his platoon. I would play against the right-handed pitcher, and Chris played against left-handed. And the pitcher would pitch a good game when I was catching. The reporter would always go and ask the pitcher about was they calling their own game or et cetera, blah blah blah. When Chris caught a game and it was a good game, they would go to Chris. So one day, I think Gale insisted, well, I think he pitched a three-hitter. And we had, our lockers were about a couple lockers from each other, but we were sitting beside each other and we were talking about the game. And this reporter came over and he asked Gale, he said, I didn't see you shaking off very much. He said, were you calling your own game? He said, well, if you didn't see me shaking my head, shaking Jesse off, he said, how did I call my own game? You know, he said, well, I was just wondering. He said, no, what are you talking about? This is Gale Sisko. He's, I don't know, he's still coaching the big leagues now, but he's a pitcher coach. He said, just what are you insinuating? You know, he said, I've noticed that every time that Chris catches me and you interview him, when Jesse catches me, you come interview me. You're trying to say that he's not intelligent? That he said he called about as good a game as anybody I've ever had to catch me. And then it hit me that this is why they would go to Chris when he called a good game, but they'd come to go to the pitcher when I called a good game. But like I said, I had a rude awakening.
Who were the over the years that you played, who were the pitchers that were easiest to work with, and who were the ones that were most difficult to work with?
Well, I would say most all of them was easy to work with. I never had any problem because I would discuss it. We went over the game before the game. And I would always tell the pitcher, and I guess it works, I guess all the catchers do, you know, in other words, I try to work with you. In other words, once I get to know you, if I don't know a pitcher, I don't know how he works. I don't know what he likes to throw in a certain situation. But once I catch him, then I know his best pitch and I know how he likes to work. So I'll try to work with him because a pitcher doesn't want to stand out there shaking his head and wiping you off. He want to concentrate on getting hit up. So once you catch him, then you should know this as a catcher, what he likes to pitch in a certain situation. And I'd always tell a pitcher, don't you throw me with something that you don't want to throw. Because after all, you're responsible for getting hit out. I'm going to try to work with you. But if I call a pitch that you don't want to throw in a certain situation, you shake me off and I'll call what you want to call. I said, now, if I know something about this hitter that you don't know, I said, if I call a pitch and you don't want to throw it, I'll come out to the mound and we discuss it. And if you still want to throw it, that's what you're going to throw. So that's the way I dealt with all pitchers.
Do you think maybe later in your career you helped some of these young pitchers?
I know that.
Then they went on and pitched well afterwards.
Yeah, I know that. Tubb McGraw was one of the guys that, you know, I worked with them. And, you know, Chris was kind of there, was a good receiver. And we had a guy named Choo-Choo Coleman. Okay. Mm-hmm. A lot of guys that's good receivers are not good game callers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, calling a game is you got two brains. It should be two brains against one brain, hitting. Because the secret of hitting and the secret of not hitting is keeping a hit off balance. It doesn't have anything to do with how hard you throw or how good a curve you got. Because if he can stay on balance, eventually he's going to hit you. But you keep him off balance. In other words, keep him guessing. When he's looking for one thing, you try to throw him another thing. That's the secret of getting a good hit out.
You do that with like varied speeds and location.
Right.
And that's something you learned as you got to.
Yeah, catch you try to outguess him. In other words, between you and the pitcher, you try to outguess the hitter.
Yeah. Okay, so you were in Ogden and Wausau.
Wausau, Wisconsin.
That's Clovis.
Clovis, New Mexico.
Wenatchee,
Washington.
Temple,
Texas.
Monterey,
New Mexico. I mean, Monterey, Mexico. Right.
And then in 58, you went to play in the
Pacific Coast League.
Triple A for Seattle.
Right. Uh-huh. And that, all of those years, okay, you look at all of those teams that you say I played for, and you see how I hit. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things I didn't understand what was going on until later. In other words, okay, then I went to Seattle, 1958?
Mm-hmm.
1958. And I was a rookie in AAA, but they had a guy there that was a favorite, but he could, good catcher, but he couldn't hit. Then they sent me to Monterey, Mexico. And I was ready to quit. I had ready to quit baseball then, you know, because I should have never left Seattle. And I told
him. Why did you think at that time they sent you down there?
No, was it? Wait, I might have had to. What, after Seattle, what did
Seattle,
I do?
Seattle, then Monterey, then San Antonio.
That's right. That's what I thought. Right. Well, I don't know why they sent me there. I really don't. They said that this catcher was going to catch and they were going to send me to Monterey, Mexico. That's what they told me. I went to Monterey, Mexico. Then I called after I got down there. That was like the graveyard of ball players. A lot of good ball players there, but they were old ball players.
Do you remember any of the people that played notable that you played with there?
Well, I knew a lot of black players. I don't know whether they mean anything to you, but a guy named Alonzo Perry was a star in the Negro League, and a guy named Earl Tabor, the catcher, and he was real light-complected, and if he would have been the first Black to play before Robinson. Because he told me a story once. He said that the Yankees told me, he said, Earl, we can sign you and we can let you pass as a Cuban.
To change your last name.
Yeah. Well, Earl Taylor. Yeah, well, Perez, Earl Taylor, it doesn't matter. He said, but Earl, you got to stop talking so bad. But and Earl was fine until he opened his mouth, and then he said, oh, MF, MF, this, MF, that, at all. But he was a good catcher. And a guy named Eddie Locke. Was a real good pitcher. These are guys that played in the Negro League, and the Negro League was about finishing those days, you know, so they was in Mexico. And another guy named Bob Trice, he came up with the Philadelphia Athletics. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that story. Mm-hmm. He beat the Yankees 3 times. And in those days, if you beat New York, that was, your ticket was made in the big leagues. It stayed there. Now, I was in the minor leagues when he was with the Philadelphia Athletics. Connie Mack was managing then. And they came out, I read the paper where Bob Trice said he wanted to go back to AAA to improve his pitching. Well, I didn't believe this, you know. So when I saw Bob in Mexico, he was playing the Mexico City Tigers. I believe it was Tigers, right? And I said, Bob, I got to ask you something personal. You know, I said, once you get to the big leagues, I said, why did you want to go back to the minor leagues? He said, I didn't want to go back to the minor leagues. I said, well, the paper said you did. He said, well, that's what the paper said. He said, but I didn't want to go. So we were standing out on the field. I said, well, why did you put that in the paper? He said, you see sitting right up there? He pointed up in the stands, and he had his white wife up there. He had picked in Canadian, in Canada. He had his white wife. And he said, she picked me up one day outside of Shot Park, I believe, or Cunningham's, wherever Philadelphia was playing in those days. Cunningham saw her, and he confronted him the next day and asked him, did I see a white lady picking you up? He said, yes, that's my wife. And the day after that, he called him into the office and said that you married to a white woman, you can't stay in the big leagues.
They were just that blatant about it. They didn't try to come up with another
excuse. No. Nothing excuse. They just put in the paper. What was in the paper said right. He asked to be sent back. But that was it.
And never made it back to the major
league. Never made it back to the major league. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the guys that was in, you know, in Mexico. But anyway, I told Cincinnati, I said, if you don't get me out of here, I'm going to quit, which I was, you know. And they sent me to San Antonio, and that's where I came up with the nickname. They gave it a nickname, Hit It Yonder Gonda in San Antonio.
And what was it?
Hit It Yonder Gonda.
Hit It Yonder Gonda.
Yeah. When I got in San Antonio, the wind blew in from right field all the time. And they said, well, right, left-hand hitters don't hit them out of San Antonio. I hit it through the wind. I forgot how many I was hitting.
Hit nine
in about, well, I guess
51 games.
Yeah, uh-huh, right.
And they had you playing third base, too.
Yes, there. I played third base. Because they had a black guy named Sam Harrison, catcher. I think his son, his grandson is in the big leagues now. He was with the White Sox.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Harrison, right. Yeah. That's, well, right. He was catching, and he was a good catcher. So, and he was a pretty good hitter in those days, but he was old. And he had played in the Negro League. So, Grady Hatton was the manager, and he said, and he had some good, pretty good outfielder. They got a guy named Joe Caffey. He went to the big leagues too. He's in the outfield, and he said, "I want to put you. He said, I want to play you somewhere." He said, "You ever tried third base?" I said, "Play anyway. I could care less." So they put me in third base.
And how'd you do?
I didn't make an error. Put it like that. I played about 4 or 5 games. And then I went to the outfield. And then I went back behind home plate because I was killing balls. I was hitting. I guess for the first 2 or 3 weeks there, I hit about 600.
Yeah, you ended up batting 320.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
328.
Yeah.
Now tell me about when you're in Mexico. I guess you didn't. The racism was less.
No, it wasn't in the racism.
It was totally non-existent.
No, non-existent. Right. Mexico. It was just added. I was a young player. I was married. I had a daughter, and by bouncing around, traveling around like I did, I never got a chance to take my family with me. They wasn't making enough money to take my family with me. But Mexico was, I enjoyed Mexico.
Really?
Yeah.
How was it, you know, not speaking the language? And the
Well, I could speak Spanish fluently.
I
used to speak Spanish fluently.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, because...
working with the pitchers, you had to.
Yeah, well, I took it a little bit in high school. And then all through the minor leagues, I played with Spanish players. The majority of the time, I was the only black American on the team. There were black Latins, black Cubans, black Puerto Ricans, and the majority of them couldn't speak English. So in order for me to communicate with them, I had the basic of Spanish. Then they was teaching me Spanish and I was teaching them English, what English I knew. But yeah, I had no problem with that, with the Spanish language. And then yes, I guess it's got to be pretty hard, because it's one thing that you want to know. The one thing you got to know is you got to work with the pitchers so you don't get crossed up back there. I never got my fingers broken or anything.
I was going to say, when I talked to Mr. Triandos, his hands looked like they came out of a meat grinder.
Yeah, because
he was
ahead of me. And the gloves was rounder, and that was one problem I had with the round gloves. You had to catch both hands.
Mm-hmm.
Then the gloves got to be more modern. I had, well, my grandson got them now, but I had the gloves that I my last years of baseball. So it became one-handed. It became a one-handed catcher. Now, they credit Johnny Bench with being the inventor of the one-handed. Yeah, he was the first good catcher that
but
was a one-handed catcher.
No,
just use the one hand. But I did it before he did.
Hmm.
But it's just I did it. I wasn't, you know, as famous, good a catcher as Johnny Banks. But that's when I improved my catching, when I started to, well, get back to what Jim Higgins told me. He told me to receive the strikes and catch everything else.
Right. Right.
That's what stuck with me.
Yeah.
And that's when catching started to become easy with me.
Right.
When I learned how to receive the strikes, but anything else, you just catch. It doesn't matter,
right,
because it's not a strike anyway.
Well, what he was saying is that you can mess up a strike by going out after.
Yeah, right, right. That's what he's saying. Well, basically what he was saying is anything that's in the strike zone, you receive it, make it look good for the umpire, and to frame it, you know, stuff mm-hmm. like this. But if it's out of the strike zone, don't worry about trying to get in front of it. Just catch the ball. You know, if you got a man on third base and see, I was trying to get in front of everything. Anything on your right, and you tell people throwing ball 95 miles an hour, so you're trying to get in front of it. Impossible. Impossible. And I didn't realize this until Higgins got me. He said, you cannot get in front of a fastball. You've got to reach, get it, backhanded. Curveballs, you can get in front of it because it's slower. And this is when catching started to become easy to me.
Now, did you ever have to catch any knuckleballers?
Oh, yes. Phil Negro.
And what was that like?
We played an exhibition game when I was with the Milwaukee Braves in Atlanta the year before they moved there. And I caught Phil Negro. And when you don't catch regular, you're kind of out of shape. You maybe gain a little weight because you got to really work hard to stay down. I lost 13 pounds. We played a night game in Atlanta, and I lost 13 pounds. I was walking around, and it's like I got into a bathtub with my shoes on. It was just, that's how they were sounding, this cushion. But, I caught knuckleball. You didn't catch a knuckleball. You just tried to stop it.
What was the, as far as defensively, who were some of the harder pitchers to catch that you caught? Either because of wildness or in the dirt?
All of them with the Mets, the young pitchers.
Really?
All of them. That's why I can't hardly walk now. I got arthritis knees. I got a hip replacement. I got arthritis wrists. Yeah. I got, you know. But all with the Mets, you had a bunch of young pitchers. I mean, really young pitchers. The pitchers that you didn't have weren't young was the Warren Spahn and the Galen Sisco and Aaron Jackson and the Tracy Stollard. After that, it was all young pitchers.
Yeah, all in their 20s.
Yeah.
Sisco, Hook.
Well, Hook was one of them. He's wild.
Grover Powell.
He's wild. Go ahead. If you name him out.
Al Jackson.
Well, Al Jackson was wild. That's why he's one of the veterans. He wasn't old, but he was control pitcher.
Ed Bauta.
Ed Bauta, he was wild.
Craig Anderson.
Well, all these names, yeah, right. All of them was terrible. No, I'm not Al and Sisco and them was not. I'm talking about all these other guys you named.
Well, let's see what your fielding was that year. Well, you still fielded 978. Yeah. You only made three errors.
Yeah, well, errors, no, but what about pass ball? Errors. I never made a lot of errors because errors coming from throwing. I could always throw the ball.
I guess you don't have pass balls on here.
But when you had cussed me in the dirt on your knees and everything, I had no idea that this was going to affect me this way. Got older.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's why they call us the hapless Mets. You know, because the pitchers, even Tug McGraw was wild. Then he really improved.
So all these years from 55 to, I'm trying to do this like in history.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. From 55 until the end of 58.
Okay.
Do you remember any of your managers there? You told me one of them, the guy at San Antonio.
The guy was John Strether was at Warsaw. A guy named Suchak was at Ogden, Utah. That was my first year. And the third year was, who was my manager?
It was Clovis Winans.
Yeah, Clovis. Yeah, I don't know. I forgot who the manager was then. But my fourth year, well, Warsaw, Wisconsin was John Strezel. John Strezel. And my fourth year, what was I at my fourth year?
Seattle, Monterey.
Okay. Grady Hatton was at Seattle. Monterey, they had, I think it was Preston Gomez.
Oh, really?
But yeah, because he had played with him in San Diego. No, it was Garza, a guy named Garza. Garza. And, no, San Antonio was Grady Hatton. Seattle, I don't know who was at Seattle, but the guy that stand out with me was minor league was Preston Gomez, Grady Hatton. Preston Gomez was at Havana, Cuba. Grady was at San Antonio, and I forgot who was at Seattle. It slipped my mind.
That's all right. Well, I want to talk about Havana now.
Yeah, Havana
was.
Yeah, Havana was...
I went on the website and found this thing. I couldn't believe what I heard about that.
Havana was the greatest. I enjoyed Havana better than I enjoyed any place in the minor leagues because I had my family with me. I had my wife and my daughter. And I was the only black American on the Havana Sugar Cane. And they had three or four white Americans on there. And all the rest of them was Cuban. And we had a good team. We had a real good team. We had Tony Gonzalez was on that team. A guy named Carlos Parla was on that team. And a pitcher named Gary Douglas was on that team. He was a pretty good pitcher.
How about Leo Cardenas?
Leo Cardenas was shortstop on that team.
And Mike Cuellar.
Mike Cuellar was a pitcher on that team.
Luis Arroyo
was a pitcher on that team.
Orlando Pena. And then there were former major leaguers, Sandy Conseguerga.
Sandy, he was
those guys were at the end of their career.
Yeah, they was in the
and then Raul Sanchez
was a spitballer.
And then good a bunch pitcher. Of native Cuban guys.
Yeah, they're all over Cuban. All these guys are right. And they had Esquerda, a catcher, and me and him the two of us was catching. And Rogelio Alvarez was the big first baseman on that. Now, he got hurt, and he was the first baseman. But Gonzalez was, we had three or four or five guys on that team that went to the big leagues. And the incident you're talking about was July, I believe, June or July.
July 25th.
July the 25th, which was like the 4th of July over here. That's when they celebrated, when Castro first started his move against Batista, the revolution. And we was playing in Rochester, the Rochester with Red Wing, I never forget. And Frank Verde, Leo, I think Frank Verde was third base coach. But anyway, what happened? We went in the extra inning. If we don't go in the extra inning, none of this would have happened. We went into extra inning, and they start celebrating at 12 o'clock, after 12 o'clock. And they start shooting guns. And Frank Verde, Leo Cardis got shot, I guess from a ricochet bullet because it creased his back. And Frank Verde, if he, we had an inner line that we wore in our caps then, you know, kind of protection. If he didn't have it on, he probably would have got killed. Because he hit him right in the inner line, and about, I guess, a tenth of an inch of a bullet was sticking out that line, and it just knocked him out.
Now, were these guys, were the people who shot these guns, were the, you're saying the people got hit with by accident? They were celebrating, or were they actually shooting at
the player? No, they were celebrating. It wasn't malicious. No, they were celebrating. In other words, just like here on the 4th mm-hmm. of July, where people shoot. Mm-hmm. No, that's why it's out. That's why it's outlawed now, right. You know, because
bullet
comes down. That's exactly what happened. And they were shooting. See, during those days, Castro was really a baseball nut. He had ambitions of being a professional baseball. I got to meet Castro. I used to catch him, warm him up on the sideline.
You met?
Oh, sure, I met Fidel. I had a photo with Fidel. Somebody stole it. I don't know where it is, but... I had a photo taken with Fidel. What would happen, when he would come to the ballpark, they would have hundreds and hundreds of soldiers all over the roofs, and he'd come in the center of the dugout, and they'd run us out of the dugout. Like, you know, they had all these young kids, and they had rifles and stuff, and we would move out and let him in. So Fidel would come in with his fatigues and everything on, and he wanted to warm up. If I was playing, then the other guy warmed him up. But this time, Escudero was catching, and I was in. He came in and threw.
Now, what were they saying? They said he might have been able to play minor league ball.
Yeah, maybe so. He threw. He's pretty good.
Really?
He threw the ball good. He threw the ball good. He just loved that.
He wasn't even, he was probably in pretty good shape then.
He was very good shape. He was very good shape, yeah. And after he finished throwing everything, we took a picture together, and he gave it to the owner of the club. And the owner club gave it to me, and it got misplaced. To this day, I'm very sorry that happened. Somebody stole it, I believe.
Now, in this particular game, you were involved in a real controversial play, right? It says, yeah. Rochester took the lead in the top of the 11th inning on a Billy Harrell home run.
Right.
But the Sugar Canes responded quickly with a double from the bat of Jesse Gonder. As Gonder ran towards second base, Rochester manager Ellis Cott Deal noticed that Gonder had missed first base.
No, I don't know. I think he accused me of missing first
base. Deal immediately confronted first base umpire Frank Cazetta, who as part of a three-man umpire was running towards second base ahead of Gonder and did not watch the runner behind him.
Well, I think I do remember that he accused me of missing first base, but it didn't stand up.
The debate between Deal and Cazetta escalated to Deal giving the umpire the choke sign. Cazetta... The response was immediate, and Deal was out of the game. And said that got the crowd going.
Yeah, he threw him out.
They started shooting big time.
No, they didn't shoot. It wasn't, see, I don't know where they get this from. It was not an incident where they were shooting at people. It was all a celebration. But any time that you were shooting a gun, it's dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so that's when they pull us off the field. Yeah. After Leo got shot, Frank Verde got shot. I think it was Verde. I'm not sure it was, because Jim Fry was on that team, and you know, with Rochester,
right?
Yeah, and that's when they pulled us off the team. But no, it wasn't they were not shooting at anybody. They were just celebrating with guns, and you get a bunch of kids that's immature, I should say, shooting guns. You got a problem.
They've probably been drinking too.
I don't know. I don't know whether they've been drinking or not. No, they were just celebrating.
So Deal left the game, gave the lineup cards, handed it over to Verde.
Verde, right? Uh huh.
That's and then you got knocked in to tie the score in the 12th.
Right, uh-huh.
And then the next inning is when Verdi got
shot. When Verdi got shot. That's right. Leo
was wearing the plastic batting
liner. That's exactly right. Now, that's correct. And Leo Connors got hit in the back.
And they said after that, the team was disbanded?
No.
What happened?
They took us off the field, but the next week, they stopped the game. But then we continued. We finished that season. That season, they had to look. They used to have a junior world, little world series, International League versus the American Association versus the International League. We were the International League. We had Miami, Havana, Montreal, Toronto, Rochester, Buffalo, and Columbus. No, in Richmond. Yeah, but in Richmond, right. Now, we won the International League, and Minnesota won the American Association. They had Bob Allison, and I don't know, all those guys on it. And we had a best of seven, just like they did in the World Series, and we beat them. We won it. Then the next year, the team was broken up.
Right.
They went to New Jersey. And I went to Richmond, or the International.
So there was.
Right, right. Well, it wasn't. That's another story. That's not baseball, but it was not communism when he first took over. It didn't have anything.
It was socialism more.
Yeah, yeah. It would. Well, that's what it was all about, you know, because it was. When I was in Havana, there were certain places that we weren't allowed to go because of the gambling and the mafia. I don't know whether you saw the picture.
Godfather.
It's
one of my favorites.
Yeah, well, Godfather,
yeah,
right. When it was up on the, when it was up, I don't know whether they really made that movie there or not, but that's the way it was.
Right.
I was across the street. We lived across the street from that hotel that they were in. And we could look out my window, see George Raft, saw Rita Hayworth, and they all used to come out and go to this big gambling, whatever it was, you know. But we weren't allowed to go.
How about Ernest Hemingway? Did you ever meet him?
No, I didn't.
He used to live in Havana.
Yeah, but we weren't allowed to go in that hotel.
So if you wanted to go gamble,
we could. I said we weren't even allowed in there. But when Castro took over, then he took all of that. A lot of money was lost.
Have a lot of people, anybody who's interviewed you, they always ask you about this game?
No.
Really?
No. They don't. You're the first one that asked me about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I just got lucky. I go on.
Yeah.
This is the great thing about the internet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They got a whole article about it with your picture in it, too. See?
Yeah. I saw that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But I really enjoyed the event. And I'm looking forward to going back there if I'm still alive and they ever go back with, with the relationship.
That'd be great.
No, I mean, with the United States, where you can travel free.
Right. Exactly.
Back and forth, right.
Right. Okay, so then the next year you went to Richmond, which was AAA.
AAA.
And that was probably your best year to date in the minors. Right?
That's where, right, because I stayed, I didn't go anywhere. I stayed with Richmond.
109 games.
Now, I was, I wouldn't let the minor league that year, but I wasn't up enough. Because Jim Fry hit 315 and I hit 325, I think. But I didn't have enough at bat.
Mm-hmm. 327.
327. Jim Fry led the league with 315.
13 home runs, 45 RBIs.
Mm-hmm.
And then they let you have a cup of coffee at the end of the season?
With the Yankees. Well, they called me up. Well, let me explain to you what happened.
Okay.
This, when I was with Seattle, they... In those days, what they would do was loan ball players from one organization to the next organization as if you're needed. In other words, Richmond needed a catcher. Seattle didn't need a catcher. So I belonged to the Cincinnati Reds up until that day on organization. So they told me that I had been signed to Richmond, and I refused to go. Because you remember a while back I told you about a guy named Kurt Roberts that went to McClymonth,
mm-hmm.
and he went to the big league with Pittsburgh for a little cup with a cup of coffee. Well, he was one of the better minor league ball players that never got a really good shot to the big leagues. And he played at Richmond, and they ran him out. But they didn't want no blacks there, period. No blacks had ever played with Richmond. Richmond was all white. Mm. So when they told me I was going, I said, no way, I'm not going. So I left Seattle. I came home in Oakland. I was living right up here on Whitney Street. And I stayed there for about 2 weeks. And finally they caught up with me. A guy named Jack White was the minor league. He eventually ended up with the 49ers, working in the office with the 49ers. But he was the general manager, minor league director with the Yankees. He called me. He said, "Why aren't you in spring training?" I told him, "I'm not going down there." You know, I said, "They don't want any." In those days, this was Negro. I said, "They don't want a Negro in Richmond." He said, "Well, you're not playing for them. You're playing for us." I said, "Well, if I got to go down there and take the abuse," I said, "I should get paid for it." So he said, "Well, how much you want?" Well, you know, I've been used to playing with Cincinnati. They're the cheapest organization that I've ever dealt with, basically. I was only making $1,000 a month. Then this is AAA. Instead of me saying another $1,000, I said $500 more. He said, "We'll catch the next flight." I said, "Oh, my God, what have I done? I could ask for more, you know?" I went to Richmond, and I was spring training in Florida, Plant City. And I was there for about 3 weeks. And we went to Richmond, and I wasn't playing. But I was pinching, and I was hitting. Every time I pinched, I was hitting. I guess I was hitting almost 1,000 pinching. And the guy was pitching no-hitter, and I broke it up. And I'm the only black guy with Richmond. We had a guy named Darren Johnson, a guy named Ken Hunt, Jim Pasoni, Fritz Pakel, Zach Monroe, Billy Stafford, these guys went to the big leagues.
And who was the manager?
Steve Suchon. Don't forget, Steve Suchon. So I'm really disgusted by now, you know. I don't know why I'm not playing. So Columbus came to town. Columbus had all the black players on it. They had Bob Veal, Al Jackson, Benny Daniels, Don Clendenin. They had all these, they had them all. So I was glad to see them come. And we was out on our party. And that Saturday, they had put an article in the paper about why isn't Gunda playing. You know, we were struggling. But I went out. I didn't say that because I wasn't playing. I didn't care. When I got to the ballpark, Suchok said, "You're playing." And I played a doubleheader. I think I lost about 13 pounds, but I got, I was up 9 times. I got 5 hits. And we won the doubleheader.
And you were hungover?
But you don't, in those days, you know, you're young. You sweat it out. It's no big deal. So anyway, what I'm getting to now, this guy interviewed me. Now everything went great. They cheered me every class, you know, because I led the team to a doubleheader. The reporter interviewed me, and he said, "What part of Cuba were you born in?" Now you listen, the way I talk, I'm a country boy. I'm born in. You know? I said, "What are you talking about? What part of Cuba was I born in?" He said, "Well, you played with the Sugar Canes last year." I said, "Yes." I said, "But I was born in Monticello, Arkansas, and I grew up in Oakland, California. And I went to school with Frank Robinson, Vader Pinson, and Curtis Flood." The next day, big headlines, big article in Sporting. And he says, the Husky Negro catcher. That night, I started, I'll never forget, Zach Monroe was pitching. And he bounced the ball halfway between home plate and me. And the ball went over my head. And the guy moved up a base. Now, remember, they was giving me a standing ovation the night before. But when he wrote this article and said the stocky Negro catcher from Oakland, California, that changed the whole avenue. So somebody, it wasn't very many people in the park. Somebody in the park jumped and hollered, "Get that nigga out of there." He said, a pitcher can't sin. That's why he's wild. But I stayed, and I ended up being the most valuable player for that team. And they tried to give me a day there. But the Yankees said, no, that wouldn't be right. We had never given anybody a day. But they sent the head, one of the top black men in Richmond, because you know the segregated. That's the first time I ever seen this Ku Klux Klan. They were walking on one side of the streets, and the young black was on the other side of the streets. I said, boy, that's kind of scary, though, you know. But anyway, they sent the money down there, and this guy that I knew gave me a night. He gave me in his place. They brought luggage and stuff like this. And I'm still belong to the Yankees. So if I don't sit down the first month, you know, pinching and stuff, I would have won the batting crown, because wasn't nobody close to me hitting. I was ahead of everybody, but I didn't have enough official time to bat to win it. So when the season ended, I packed, and my wife and daughter had gone ahead, and so I said, well, I got plenty of time. I catch a train. I don't want to fly. I save my money. So I was at the train station, and they had contacted the airport, train station, bus station, and they got me at the train station. They said, you were going in Richmond, back in Richmond. And I didn't know what was going on. They said, well, is your luggage? I said, I got it. They said, well, take it with you. So I went back to Richmond. They said, go to the clubhouse. And I was at the club. I said, what's wrong now? They said, Casey wants you. I said, what? They said, you want it in New York. I said, no, I'm not. I don't belong to Yankee. They said, well, they bought you. So that night, I'm in Yankee Stadium, Google-eyed. I guess probably the biggest thrill I've ever gotten in baseball at the time, you know. You know, I'm there with Roger Maris, Mickey Mantle, with all, you know. And then we go on a road trip, and we go to Boston. And
now, had they already clinched the pennant?
Yeah, you know, I believe so. I believe they'd already clinched the pennant, but they had hit, they broke the record that year in home runs.
Right.
So I never forget my first assignment. My first pitch hit was against a guy named Frank Sullivan. And
was that your first home run in the majors?
No. That's the first pitch hit. I mean, first pitch bat. First time up at plate. That's what I should put it. That's the way I should put it. The first time, my first plate appearance in the big leagues was against a pitcher named Frank Sullivan. And they said, now watch him. He got a good changeup. Well, I didn't know he had a changeup off of a changeup. So he threw me, he went to 3-2, and then he really threw me a good changeup. I guess I missed it by 2 feet. But then Boston, we left Boston and went to New York, and they sent me up to pinch it off a guy named Frank Mumbo Kett. And that's where I got my first hit. Hit him in the bullpen.
Yeah, seventh inning.
Yeah.
It was a night game, and you were 24. Look at that. They even say how old you are in days, and you were 24, almost 25
years. Yeah, that's right. That's what happened.
September 30th.
Hit my first home run.
Wow, that must have been a big
hit. It was the greatest.
Did that decide the game, or was it a close game?
No. It was. I don't know. I don't know. I think it was a close game. All I know is it extended the home run record. And what made it so special was the guy that was playing second base for the Red Sox was a good friend of mine, Pomsa Green. He was the first black guy to play with the Boston Red Sox.
Wow.
And when I round second base, he said, congratulations. My first hit was a home run. Yeah.
So now, were you eligible to play in the World Series?
No. Yeah, I wasn't eligible to play in the World Series. No. Uh-uh.
So you didn't get a ring or a share?
No. I got a little share. Look, I got a wood. In order to appear in the World Series, you have to be on the active roster. And you have to be up before September the 1st. That year, when we went up, it was Ken Hunt, Darren Johnson, and myself. We went to the big leagues from Richmond. Now, this is where my career really started turning around. The following year, now, you got to remember, you had Yogi Berra, was first, Essen Howard was third, and another pretty good catcher, good hitter, Johnny Blanchard. I mean, Essen Howard was second, another pretty good hitter was Johnny Blanchard. He was third. Now, in 1961, I went to spring training, and it's no way that I think that the Yankees was going to keep me, because I don't see what they wanted with me. But I had such a good spring. I hit over 400 in spring. Every time they played me, I hit the ball and started the season with them. But I knew I wasn't going to play. But still, this, you know, being with the Yankees was a big thrill. Now, the California Angels was their first year. And they tried to get me. I'm telling you this because this is what I learned many years later. This is when my career started to change around. This is when I really kind of, you know, I soured on baseball. They wanted me and a pitcher named Johnny James and outfielder named Ken Hunt for Bob Serb, because they had selected Bob Serb off of the expansion draft from the Yankees, right. And the Yankees wanted Bob Serb back. So they tried to trade down. So it was rumored that the Yankees, they wanted Johnny Blanchard. But I learned later on it was they wanted me. They didn't want Blanchard. And I couldn't understand why the Yankees turned that trade down. But remember I told you Jack White was the farm director for the Yankees? When he was working with the 49ers in the front office, I forgot what it was, we was at a banquet together. This was after I'm out of baseball. And he came to me, he said, you know, you were always in the wrong place at the wrong time. This is what Jack White told me. He said, because I said, what are you talking about? I said, I know that. He said, that would have been a perfect position for you. I said, I know that. He said, but they didn't make the trade. Why didn't they? He said, they didn't make the trade because when the Yankees bought you from Cincinnati, they made an agreement with Cincinnati that when they traded you back or got rid of you, when they was ready to get rid of you, that Cincinnati would. The Yankees ended up sending me out to the minor leagues in June or July. I don't know exactly what date it was, June. And I went to Richmond again. I think the first week or so I hit two home runs and everything. But then I hurt my arm. I pulled a ligament in my hand. And they were going to call me back up. But I never got back with them. That followed winter. They traded me back to Cincinnati for a pitcher named Marshall Bridges. And
So in 60, you got the cup of coffee at the end of the
season. Right, uh-huh. 61.
Then in 61, you played in 15 games. Yeah. You batted .333.
Yeah, but I was on pitching, right. That's what I'm telling you. Yeah. Right. And then they sent me out.
And they sent you to Richmond.
Right. Yeah, because they wanted me to play. They didn't want me to sit on the bench.
Right.
I needed to play. In other words, it was a waste of my talent, and they knew I wasn't going to play because you got three guys ahead of me. They wanted to send me to Richmond. And I guess they was planning on sending me back to Cincinnati like they had agreed that winter, which they did. They returned me to Cincinnati for a pitcher named Marshall Bridges. So I go to spring training in Cincinnati, and I hit about .340 in spring training. Then Cincinnati had a young guy named Johnny Edwards. He was coming up. So it was between me and Johnny. So what Cincinnati did was said, they're going to send me to San Diego. Now, okay, I made the Yankees club in 1961. I made the team. And then in 1960, I really led the International League in hitting. Now, what could I prove in AAA? Nothing. That's when I really got angry.
That's Although you did.
Huh? Well, that's what I'm saying. I didn't go. I went home. And I stayed home for almost a month before spring training. Then I got I met one of the greatest front office men in baseball, a guy named Eddie Leishman from San Diego. Well, Preston was managing, and I played with him in Havana. And so George Poles was my high school coach, as I told you. So they was calling that. They kept asking my wife, where is it? Where is it? She said, I don't know. I said, I don't want to talk to nobody. So finally, George Poles called. And she said, this is Mr. Poles. You want to talk to him? I said, yeah. So he said, come see me. So I went out to see him. He's at McClymont's on the school. And he said, you know one thing? He said, they had you tapped, you know, he said, as a troublemaker. This is what he said, you know, you got the rap as a troublemaker. I said, how did I get the rap as a troublemaker? What have I done, you know? He said, you remember in spring training? I'll tell you the story now. He said, when you asked Mrs. Feller for some different food? I said, sure. I said, what about that? He said, well, let me tell you what happened. I said, we were complaining, Frank, Veda, we was complaining about the food that we were eating, leftovers and et cetera, et cetera. And they said, we need some meat, and we need not so much scrambled eggs with milk down, you know. And I said, well, why don't we ask, there was a guy, Bill McKegney was the minor league director with Cincinnati. I said, well, why don't we ask Mr. McKegney? Since he's paying Mrs. Felder, you know. I said, so that's no big deal. Well, Frank said, well, I ain't going to ask him. Veda said, I'm not going to ask him. I said, well, I'll ask him. What's the big deal? So the next morning, I went. Remember I told you we were living separate from the white players. So our next morning, we went to the camp. I went in to see Mr. McKegney. And I said, Mr. McKegney, I said, you know, we're getting leftover greens, and we're getting leftover this. And I said, we're getting scrambled egg that's got too much milk in it. I said, we would like to have a little better food. Now, the same day that I went, this was my rookie year, my first year down there, they called Bob Maddox and asked him, what kind of smart nigga did you sign and send us down here? Now, this followed me all the way. I said, George, what are you talking about? He said, you've always been, this is George Poles. He said, you've always been the kind of person that express yourself. You wouldn't back down with nobody. He said, but you got to be like Vader and Frank and Curtis. He said, you just got to shut up. And, you know, he said, you can't be so outspoken. But I never accepted that. I agreed. I said, okay, but that ain't me, and I never would. I'd do the same thing over again. But anyway, he said that you talk with Eddie Leishman. He said he's a good person. So I called, and Eddie Leishman said, come on down. He said, I told him, I said, I just talked to George, Mr. Poles, and he told me that I had a bad rep, a troublemaker, or anything. I said, that's a bunch of BS. He said, well, don't worry about it. He said, you come down here with a clean record, you know? I tell you a story. I was in Nicaragua playing winter ball. They accused me of taking the natives and the other players out to nightclubs. Now, how in the hell can I take somebody out? I don't know. I don't know nowhere to go. But this is how the reputation get, you know?
Right.
Because I just wouldn't, I would back down. If I figured that was right, I'm going to speak my piece.
And a rumor gets started.
And a rumor gets started. And it stays with
you. Complaining about food.
Yes, that's where it started from. And it stayed with me my whole life in baseball. So anyway, I go to San Diego, and I lead the minor leagues. I made the minor league player of the year and everything.
Well, you made, I'm sure you're in Pacific Coast history when they have their reunions and stuff.
Oh, like. Sure. Oh, yeah. I was
116 here. RBI, yes, batted 342.
Right.
21 home runs. Mm-hmm. So that was your best year, probably.
That's my best year, right?
21 home runs, 116 RBIs, 342.
And then after that, I went to the big leagues, and I didn't come out. Cincinnati traded me. I went back to Cincinnati. They traded me to the New York Mets for a guy named Charlie Neal. And I stayed with the Mets until 1960.
You got up four times for the Reds that year.
Yeah.
62.
That's 80. All. Right. That's it. I didn't want any part of Cincinnati. I didn't want any part of Cincinnati at all.
And then next year, 63.
Right, was with the Mets.
But you started with Cincinnati.
No. 60.
Oh, you didn't. Oh, no, you traded during the offseason.
I traded. That's what I'm going to say. No. I traded during the season.
Oh, okay.
In 1963, I traded for Charlie Neal.
Oh, but you never played a game in 63 for the Reds.
No, I didn't. I pitched it. I should have been. I think I maybe pitched it.
I think they just combined your stats.
Yeah. Well, I
don't 73 pitch. Games. You got a 304.
Yeah, but I didn't play a game. I didn't catch with Cincinnati. That's what it was. Pete Rose, first year. He was a rookie and everything. But I got traded to for the Mets for Charlie Neal. And I went to the Mets. I was killing the ball. I hit two home runs off of Drysdale one night in the Polo Ground. And then the following year, we opened up Shea Stadium. And I stayed with the Mets until 1965, and they traded me to Milwaukee. And then... I got to play with Hank Aaron. I got to play with Eddie Matthews. I played with some of the greatest players.
I got a list here I wanted to ask you about.
Okay.
I'll say the name, and you tell me what your first impression
was. Okay.
Okay, first we got Whitey Ford.
Good pitcher.
Did you ever get to...
Yeah, I caught him, sure. Really? I caught him, yes. Yeah, very good pitcher.
What about his after hours?
I
heard he was quite a carouser.
We all was a quite a carouser. Billy Martin and Mickey Mellon and Whitey Ford, they parted together, you know. And but I didn't do much parting with the Yankees because I was so happy to be there. Youngster, I didn't want to do anything to jeopardize, you know.
How about Ralph Terry?
Ralph Terry, a good friend of mine.
Really?
Real good friend of mine. Good buddy.
What was he like?
He was fun. Good competitor. Very good friend of mine.
And then Al Downing.
Al Downing. I didn't play with Al Downing.
Oh, you didn't?
I met Al Downing.
Oh.
I met him. We was and I knew Al Downing, but I never played with Al Downing. Al
Downing probably was, crossed each other.
Yeah, Al Downing was behind me.
Right.
Yeah, when he came up, I was I'd already left the Yankees.
He was the one who gave up the record home run.
Right, to Hank Aaron. Uh-huh.
Then Elston Howard, I'm sure.
Elston Howard was a good defensive catcher, good hitter. But Elston Howard was Lockatone. See, I'm going to tell you the way it was. You know, Elston Howard, I didn't care much for Lockatones. If you know what I'm talking about, do you know what I mean when I say Lockatone?
Oh, sure.
Oh, okay. Then you know. But that's the only rap, you know. Even when a white guy said that a black guy is Lockatone, he's Lockatone. And Jim Bowden said that, and I knew it all the time. Yeah, Ball. Oh, she must read Ball for, huh? Did he say it? I didn't read it. Did he say it in Ball for?
Oh, okay. He also didn't like, who was the guy who was real militant for St. Louis, who now works in baseball, first baseman?
Bill White. I didn't know. I just played against Bill. I didn't really know Bill well.
No.
I, you know, we all lived in the same house in spring training, but some guys you got closer to than other guys. Bill White wasn't one of the guys I got that close to.
And you think that Elston Howard was that way because he, you know, wasn't he the first black player for the
Yankees? Yeah.
You think he felt he had to be that way in order to?
No, I don't think you had to be that way. I don't really think that you ever. I'm going to put it like this. I found out through my years of dealing with people, they respect you when you stand up, whether you're white, black, red, blue, whatever it is. They respect you as a man. They might not like what you said, but they respect you. If you understand what I'm saying.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you know. And
you earn it.
You earn it. And now, Jackie and Roy Campanella.
I was going to just talk about that.
Jackie wasn't liked. But he was respected. Oh, anytime you would hear a white guy make a statement about Jackie Robinson, they would say he's competitive. You know. And he was a strong person. Now, Campanella was just opposite. They said, oh, now he's a good old boy. You know, but he, every joke that he told, he was always laughing and talking. He's the typical black man, a typical Negro, I should say, that back in those days, the white man was expected to. You smile all the time. Well, Jackie didn't.
Right.
And him and Cabot never got along.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't really understand that. They never got, that's why they didn't ever saw, that's not why they never saw eye to eye, because Jackie just didn't deal like that.
Yeah, well, Campy just wanted to get along.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one thing getting
some
along.
Some people's personalities like that. They don't want to confront. They'd rather.
Yeah, you don't have to confront.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be a stereotype either.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be the black person that's smiling every time you look at me. I'm not happy every time you look at me.
Right.
You know, you. I want you to respect me as a man.
Right.
That's all that's necessary.
Yeah. How about Moose Scourin?
Bill, good person. Good hitter. Good person.
And Bobby Richardson was on that team.
Bobby was a religious man, you know. Yeah, and, you didn't know, but, you know, Bobby was kind of quiet.
But he wasn't preachy about it.
No.
And then Tony Kubek.
Tony Kubek, good person.
Cleet Boyer.
Cleet Boyer, great. A good friend of mine.
I heard he befriended a lot of the black players.
Good player. Good friend of mine. Real good person. Real beautiful.
I heard he was an incredible builder.
Yeah, he was. He was one of the better field and third basemen I've ever seen.
And then Roger Maris. You were there.
Roger was very quiet. Roger was a good person. I felt sorry for Roger, for him to be treated, ridiculed for things that he was doing. You know, Roger was I guess, a small city boy. And he never liked New York, I don't think.
So and you I were think, there. I mean, you got to you know, see.
I got to see. I was there on, well, up until June. I got to see a lot of home runs. I saw, and he was in a position where Mickey had a better year that year, because Mickey was behind Roger, and I couldn't understand why the pitchers, they continued the true run ball they laid right here, because they didn't want to pitch with Mickey with men on base, and Roger was killing them.
And then you could see that when you were there, could you see them starting to be taken by the stress?
Yeah. I never saw that. I know, but he never, even from the beginning when he started, you know, when the reporter started writing about it, you know, Roger wasn't. I went up there when I hurt my hand. I hurt my hand in Richmond. And they called me back there to send me to the doctor and everything. And that's when I saw his hair was changed, totally changed. It was really getting to him then, because I went there and they called me up in, August to have my, see how bad my hand was.
And then, of course, Mickey.
Mickey.
Did you ever interact with him?
Oh, yeah. Mickey was a comedian. Mickey was really funny. You know, I saw Mickey in 1990 for the last time, and Mickey drank a lot. And the reason why he drank a lot is because the male members of his family had some kind of disease that nobody had lived to be 50 years old, and Mickey was under the impression that he wasn't going to live. You know, I guess two of his sons have passed down already, right. So we were talking in Atlantic City. We went to one of the memorabilia show, and he said, you know, if I'd have known that I was going to live to be as long as I live, he said, I wouldn't have drank so much.